you're listening to Crazy Shit in Real Estate, you'll be amazed at all these wild but true situations that others have found themselves in. Because on this show, you'll hear uncensored, unbelievable stories from the world of real estate. I'm Lee Brown. Let's dive right in.
Hello, friends. Lee Brown here, and it's time for Crazy Shit in Real Estate. Today's episode with Chris Miles starts off with ballroom dancing. Don't even ask yourself how. Just know that you're about to get some good advice on property management, some excellent advice on risk and return, and also maybe some insights on moving past foreclosure while you think about a house that wasn't as well built as its own doghouse. Oh, you heard me. Listen, enjoy the show, and we'll see you on the other side. Before you get the rest of the story, I'd love to share a quick message from today's sponsor.
Hey, y'all. Just going to take a quick break from this conversation to let you know about the sponsor of today's episode. That sponsor is, well, frankly, it's me. It's Lee Brown University. Look, it's no secret that real estate is crazy competitive, getting more so every day. And when the pie doesn't get any bigger, but the people wanting a piece of it do, you've got to figure out a competitive advantage. And that's why I created Lee Brown University. It's everything you need from soup to nuts, cradle to grave, point A to point B, whatever point B is. Each of you has different goals. So maybe you're a new to the career realtor, or you're a super experienced pro who can't figure out that next level. There's something in my course that's going to help you break through. It's designed for you before I even met you. So enroll in Lee Brown University today. You go to www.leebrownu.com and I'll see you there. Now back to this amazing content.
Hello, how are you?
Great.
Well, let me start recording right there. We can make this a really spicy episode if we want to, Chris. And so anyway, we'll start recording and we'll decide if you want to go spicy or not as you talk about your amazing Venezuelan wife and the great flamingo in the background. So tell us who you are, where you're located. Give all of our viewers and listeners a little bit of Chris Miles' story.
Yeah, I'm actually here in Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah, but originally grew up near Oregon and about 20 years ago moved out here because they had the two best ballroom dance programs in the country, really in the world. And so came out here and started ballroom dancing, danced on the world championship team for a few years and was going to college. I was a sociology major with a triple minor in psychology, Japanese, and ballroom dancing. So,
and ballroom dancing is probably the only useful education you got out of all those degrees, right?
Pretty much. That's the thing I excelled at, right?
Well, yeah, the rest tell me of it what kind of dancing you got. You got to go down that rabbit hole for us for a minute. What dance?
I did all 10 dances, including social dance stuff. So I did everything from Latin dancing to, you know, like the stuff you see, like the waltz, the foxtrot, quick step, you know, that kind of stuff. But I also did like, you know, samba, cha-cha, you know,
the merengue,
paso doble. Yeah, I did merengue and, you know, yeah, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I loved it.
But what's your favorite? You have to have a favorite.
Latin dancing, my favorite by far. Yeah.
Is that how you met your bride?
No, actually, she had no clue how to Latin dance. We went once on a date and I about killed her. So
so that's how it stuck. She was like, I may as well date this guy because I've never been on a date before with somebody tried to kill me by dancing. That's how you won her over. Yes.
That could be it, right? That could totally be it. So yeah, no, I think she just likes me for my rugged good looks and that kind of thing. But
happens.
I'm a smart guy. I just know how to get her, you know.
So how does a ballroom dancer wind up in Salt Lake City? Is that like a hotbed of ballroom dancing that we just didn't know about? I don't know that world at all, except for watching TV.
Yeah, actually, like in 2006, by the time I was able to become financially independent the first time, I was kind of like semi-retired. And I was even teaching, like volunteer teaching ballroom dancing at the local university. And that was that just a couple years later, that university went to Dancing with the Stars and won the collegiate championship that they had. We got the mirror ball trophy. Yeah. So yeah, it's a hotbed for dancing and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of times you see Dancing with the Stars, a lot of times the professionals are coming out of Utah if they're not coming from New York or New Jersey, right?
Had no idea. You know, in the Carolinas, we have shag. That was born here. Do you know how to shag?
Not at all. Nope.
Oh, now that's sad. You know, a guy I went to high school with, you'll probably love this. He got a full ride to Harvard because he was the national shag champion with his partner. And they had never had a college applicant who was a
national shag champion, and that was his advantage. So dancing brings a lot of advantages besides physical fitness.
It sure does. Yeah. You never know.
All right. So tell us a little bit about Beyond Ballroom Dancing, because I love getting distracted by fascinating stories. What do you do in and around real estate? How long did you do it? How'd you land here? What's your excitement?
Yeah. So real estate investing, I've kind of had the love-hate relationship with it, right? Because I've always come at it as being an investor. You know, I especially love being more of a passive investor. So currently I do more investing like turnkey rentals, right? Where I'm not the property manager. I hate property management. I did that before the last recession, and that was just a nightmare. So I do more of the hands-off, you know, just kind of more buying and just taking long-term rentals, passive income from that, you know, that sort of thing. And I do other things like I'm in syndications with apartments and, you know, and land deals and things like that. But ultimately, like, that's more my love, is doing more the passive turnkey real estate investing.
All right. So tell us about the first real estate investment you ever purchased, and also all the emotions that go along with that, because we know that in the investing space for real estate, a giant hurdle to overcome is often fear, because there's so many negative stories out there about how awful it can be, bad tenants, wild situations, which are definitely anomalies, but people get very hung up on anecdotal stories. So how did you get past those emotions, and tell us about that first property?
Yeah. So the first property was converting my first home to a rental, right? So I bought my first home. It was a 1971 Rambler. You know, it had and vintage everything. It had the fiberglass carport. You couldn't park all the way in because the stairs were in the way. And you had the calico colored shag carpet, and in green shag too. That one was so long, it would kill our vacuum cleaner.
Vacuum that, Chris. Did you not know you rake shag?
I should have chopped it. You know, like you had to do something to that thing.
That was a kid job when I was little. Rake the shag. You'd rake up like a quarter here and there and think you'd been like, you found all the money in the world.
Oh yeah, man. Those shag carpets were so long. Like, we had a cat in the house, and you swear it was like the African bush, right? Like, you just see this little tail bobbing through, you know, the little green shag and stuff. So it was crazy stuff. You know, we even had the wallpaper that had like the fuzzy designs on it.
Oh, velvet wallpaper?
Oh yeah.
I love that stuff. That stuff is golden now if you can find it. Of course, you know, 3 feet tall, it gets rubbed off because little kids walk through a house like they're blind.
Oh yeah. Well, I felt it for a while too. Then after a while, I was like, what am I doing? This stuff is gross. You know? So we eventually replaced that. We even added a bedroom to make it a 4-bed, you know, 2-bath. And then we got to the point of 2006, right? So everything's getting hot and money started coming more readily too. So I was ready to upgrade to a different house. We were having more kids and things like that. So I was like, all right, what am I going to do with this property? Well, there's a local real estate group. And of course, back then, everything was about being creative. Loans were easy to come by, right? You could do, I mean, especially with investment properties, you could pretty much do almost like zero down, you know?
No doc, stated income.
Yeah, stated income, no doc. I mean, it was awesome. And I was a mortgage broker then too. So I remember those days, you know, it was easy getting a loan. So what I did, it was my most creative deal, but it was also probably the dumbest deal I did too, right? So what I did is I bought it for less value when I bought it back in, like, what was it, 2003? Now it was 06. So I'm looking to sell it. So I sold it to an investor with agreement to lease it back, right?
Oh, no.
So did that, and because I wanted to get all the equity out so I could strip out the equity, go and invest that elsewhere. So now I'm fully leveraged. You know, it was like about 100. It was only 165,000, but I bought it for like 115, right? So I thought I was a hero. I thought I was a champ. Well, and then of course I go to try to, you know, do a lease option or do, you know, start renting it out. I was the property manager, which was not a good thing. I rented it to somebody who lived a couple blocks away. I should have known when I went to her place that she was already trashing her apartment. Why wouldn't she do the same thing to my house? Right. So, I mean, I left all the appliances there. I left the lawnmower there and everything just to, you know, have it fully, not fully furnished, but semi-furnished. Right. Well, long story short, they stopped paying. They didn't keep the place clean. A year later, and I'm not the kind of guy to be a jerk. Like, I like to be more a friendly guy. So I finally just had to say, you got to get out. Like, you haven't been paying consistently, and you know, I need you out now. So finally kicked them out. By the way, they were on government support. That was the thing. Half their rent payment was coming from government support, and they still couldn't make the payments. Well,
would it make the payments? We should probably clarify. Some people that can won't.
But they don't.
So yes. Let's just say they wouldn't make the payment.
Exactly. Yeah, there's always an excuse, always a story, right? And of course, I would go for the sob stories for a while. Eventually, it was just a nightmare. And of course, now it's 2008 by about this time, right? So the market's already tanking. I go and put up a for sale by owner sign. I hadn't walked through it yet until somebody like immediately called on it, wanting to look at the property. So the first time I walked through the property after evicting them was in that moment with those buyers, which is another bad no-no, right? And again, for sale by owner didn't help either. So anyways, I'm walking them through and I see like there's pizza like stuck to the carpet. This is in the middle of winter too. So it's kind of gross. There's holes in the sheetrock. They had stolen appliances and my lawnmower. So they stole everything. So the funny thing is the guy was very handy that lived there, but he wasn't handy inside the house. And there was food on the walls. It was just disgusting. The only thing that stood up was the thing I told him not to do was have a dog, which was a dog house that he had built. And when we tried to have 1-800-GOT-JUNK to destroy it, it was almost impossible. The thing was so well built, but they trashed the house. Like that was the best part of the house now. So, I mean, eventually, luckily, I was able to almost break even. Like other than some of those costs, I was able to get out from under it. But man, it was just a nightmare. And it actually scared me from doing rentals until about 2015, 2016. I was pretty much like, I'll be done, you know? And that's when I started going more the turnkey route of, hey, let somebody else property manage. I'm going to buy in better areas, not buy in a place where I'm fully leveraged, not buy in a place like in this Western half of the United States where rentals stink anyways, you know, like more out east, like Southeast or Midwest is where I've been more buying rentals now.
So talk to us a little bit about the ability to select a property manager. We've had a lot of investors and a lot of people in the investment space on the show. And one of the pieces of feedback I get back is, all right, so what do I do? You have chosen not to dabble in the property manager space because, as you know, it is a high headache business and it's low margin side. And it really takes somebody who knows the law and understands how to read through a tenant who knows the law better than most landlords do. So if you're the passive investor and you've created a turnkey property, how do you pick a property manager? What are the best questions to ask? Because as you will already attest, it's not always about the fees. That's not your first question.
No, definitely not. I mean, there's different ways to go about it. Like when I go buy turnkey properties, I'm using a turnkey company that supplies it, right? So that for me, like it's nice because usually it's one of two things. Either one, they've contracted a property management company where they are the majority of the business. So if something goes wrong and we're complaining to that turnkey company, they can say, hey, you guys don't shape up, you're fired and your business will pretty much go under if we pull out. So that's one option. Or the other option is more common is turnkey providers are the ones that usually flip the house to you, right? They turn around, they renovate it, fix and flip it to you at more retail price. And then they turn around, they property manage it for you. Now, definitely reputation is everything, right? I mean, online reviews help. I think a good question to ask, of course, is just asking them like, hey, like, can I talk to some of your landlord, you know, not landlords, but like the owners, people you're managing for?
Oh, that's a great idea. List.
You know, just ask for references, right? And just get their real feedback. I mean, I'm dealing with a property management company right now in Alabama that, you know, they're not, at least the person we have working for us, the rep is not doing a great job. And I've learned, you know, like I had one client, same problem. Like she had a property management firm, specifically the rep that was part of that company said, hey, you know what? I know you said no dog policy, but if we allow dogs, we'll have more rental options. And she's like, are you sure? Because I thought we had plenty of rental options. Like, no, I think you'll be good. Oh, but if you want a dog, you have to build a fence. So we at least need to build a cyclone fence for $650. And she came to me and she said, what do you think? You know, because I'm more advisor like on the consulting side, right? And I said, no. In fact, we're going to complain right now. So we went through the turnkey company, complained to them. They went back to the property management company. And what ended up happening is they said, you know what? You're fired. They fired the person. The next week got a new rep on it. And within a week, they got a renter at exactly the market price they were hoping for. No dog, no fence needed. And so sometimes it's not even just the company, sometimes just the rep that you have. The most important thing is that you're proactive and that you act quickly. If you have hired them and something's not working, let the company know, go to the CEO if you have to, or the COO, you know, whoever's running operations and say, this isn't working, fix it or you're out, you know, and we're getting a new one, you know?
And there's a lot of people that they buy near where they live, but as you've already mentioned, the best values in the market might not be where you live. California being a prime example where the taxes and the cost of living are so high. I have some people who have purchased homes in North Carolina from California where they don't even own a primary residence. They rent because they can't afford to buy in their market, but they can afford to buy here. So to those people, the property manager becomes their eyes and ears on the ground.
Yeah.
And a tip that I learned years and years ago from another investor friend was to make sure your property manager is willing to go monthly and change the air filters and check the smoke detector battery. So first of all, that's some maintenance on the heating and air unit, which in the South is a super important thing in July and August.
Oh, yeah.
But also it protects the safety aspect, checking that smoke detector, and happens to be a set of eyes in the house monthly to keep an eye on things. And those are pretty common sense things that any property manager is willing to do. But you A, have to ask, and B, like you said, you have to have the right rep. If you have somebody who's I won't say lazy, but less motivated, they may or may not be willing to go do that because they don't want to go through the hassle. But honestly, you're going to get better tenants if they know you're taking better care of a property. That's right. About your investment strategy, how do you pick properties in a market such as the, we're recording this, by the way, at the beginning of June 2021, when the market is still ridiculously high. It feels frothy in a lot of markets. We don't have enough inventory. Of course, the cost of new construction is something you just can't peg right now because lumber is crazy. So when you look at all the factors right now, there's still opportunities to buy no matter what's happening.
That's right.
What are your criteria? Or if you don't want to give us a criteria that you use as a marker when you're picking a property.
Yeah, generally, I like areas that, if the turnkey company's there, right? I like areas that where they've got multiple industries. It's not like a one-horse town, like Vegas. Like, you don't want to be in Vegas where it's all based on tourism and hospitality. You can't, you know.
Dude, that's Sodom and Gomorrah. There's going to be a pillar of salt at the entrance to that city at some point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just like Detroit was, you know, before the last recession, it was all automotive. And then when that crashes, the whole thing falls apart, right? So you want a place that's really diverse with their industries so that even if one industry goes down, it doesn't wipe out the whole town and then you're struggling, right? I also like places that have lower prices with higher rents, you know, higher market rents in comparison. So seeing how that looks. Personally, I like to go, like when I know I get a mortgage on a property, say I put 20 or 25% down on a property, I want to get at least a 10 to 12% cash on cash return. You know, just like I have a property in Fayetteville, North Carolina right now, and that thing's doing great. And right now in North Carolina, the rents are starting to boom with what's going on, which is great because we want that because that keeps me in the property more because my return on equity is still good, right? So I'm looking at the numbers too. Definitely, I don't like to buy in any like C and D class type neighborhoods. You know, I've seen a lot of people come to me and they're like, yeah, I've got 5 rental properties and they're all in Columbus, Ohio, which can be a decent market. But then you find out they're buying this $40,000 or $50,000 properties that are just pieces of crap and they never appreciate. So there's no potential growth on it. And that might cash flow okay, but you attract really interesting tenants sometimes, right? You often will be getting like Section 8 or something like that. And that could be good or bad. So really determine up front what kind of tenants you want to attract. You know, for my wife and I, like we really want families, you know, so we want to make sure we're getting at least the Goldilocks 3-bedroom, 2-bath, you know, maybe a 1-bath, but for the most part, it's at least a 3-2, right? If not bigger. And we don't want to buy over median price either. So in that area, if the median price is 250, we want to be buying under that price. So if things do go to crap, right? Then we at least know we can turn it around. We can say, hey, this is an underpriced place. If there is a recession and people start downsizing, they're going to downsize into my property, which either means rents will go up and or the price of the value of my home will still hold and go up as well.
And of course, fair housing disclosure here. Chris is not precluding anybody from renting his properties that doesn't have that Goldilocks life. He's just saying, if you have a property where you can attract a family with little kids, it's generally going to be on the safer side. It's generally going to have a good neighborhood around it. But anybody could rent that house and he is not going to violate any of the HUD protected classes because that would be crazy. Then you would be keeping your tenant market smaller than it has to be. And then back to the concept of the less expensive houses and Section 8, the biggest thing you guys want to think about as you're looking at investment properties is what Chris already said, know your strategy.
there are a lot of super successful investors that focus on Section 8 housing because the numbers can work. And if you have a heart for creating housing solutions for folks in our society who do need a hand out from the government for whatever reason, disabled vets, senior citizens with no income any further, there can be opportunity there to be a solution provider of decent housing at that price point. It's just a matter of understanding what your risk tolerance is and what market you're in so that you can be fully educated on pros and cons. He's just stating that's not his favorite kind of opportunity. I personally love it because I look at this as a way to be a part of the housing shortage solution, but that's where I am in life and where my risk tolerance is. And so full disclosure to you, wherever you're looking to buy, talk to your realtor partner and get some feedback. I love the idea of looking at the industry and where the jobs are coming from in a given area, because a little bit of diversity in job types is also a hedge against future market changes. As we saw in Kannapolis, North Carolina, when Cannon Mills went away in 2003, that was a mass layoff of 3,000 people, and there was nothing else to replace it because Kannapolis was a textile town. Now, of course, they have really changed and made some huge comebacks, but that took almost 20 years. So it's a great way to look at a market and ask lots of great questions and think about, too, where the politics start to play in and what's happening with unionization and right to work laws. And you're thinking, what's that got to do with real estate? Well, it has everything to do with economic development. Economic development means jobs. Jobs means tenants and property owners and new construction and new builds. So you're thinking about the holistic look at the market, which I find that to be a unique investor perspective, because many investors only look at cash on cash return, only look at what they're leveraging before they look at the bigger picture of the market. So how did you come to the realization that you needed those data points in addition to the numbers on a house to make a great decision? Was that a trial and error? Or did you have a mentor at some point that gave you that information?
Or had a mentor. Yeah. I mean, definitely with some of those turnkey companies that have like their 8-point, you know, kind of check before they even go to a market. And you're right. Like, it definitely look for landlord friendly states. Like, I'm always amazed when I'll have guests on my own podcast, like they're in the Chicagoland area and they'll say like, yeah, I'm doing real estate investing there. I said, how? Chicago is a massive HOA. Like, it's such a horrible place. You know, it's massive taxes. Now there's some benefits, like you said, like Section 8, if they're focused there, they can maybe make it work. But I'm like, wow, that for me would be too high of a risk to, you know, risk to take. You know, for me, I like very low risk, very easy. That's why I have like, you know, properties in like Memphis or Fayetteville, North Carolina, or like Alabama, or looking at like Missouri and places like that, or Oklahoma, where it's just easier. It's easier for the landlords to be able to fight it if case something goes wrong, you know, despite moratoriums and all that stuff going on now.
Right. I think we're moving past that finally now that many of our states are getting their economies fully reopened. And we're finding that a lot of jobs are going unfilled. So if our folks will just get back out there and decide to embrace the pride of a job well done, we can fix a lot of these problems. So, of course, the premise of the show is crazy shit in real estate. And we just talked a lot about some strategies and some tips and tricks. But my listeners really want to know what you've seen out there. So if you look back in your memory bank of all the real estate stuff that you've done pre-recession, during the recession, here in the current boom that we're experiencing, what's that one thing that you saw, you still can't believe it happened, you still can't believe you saw it, but you didn't get out of the real estate space altogether? What's the one story, Chris?
Well, it was really that first one I shared. You know, that very first property was like, that was the one that it almost kept me out of real estate completely. You know, other than maybe buying my own home, like I was so scared and gun shy to go back in. You know, like it really took me. That's why I went the turnkey route, right? Because when I knew that they were doing a lot of the filters and they were doing a lot of the homework for me, right? And especially if I was looking outside of the state of Utah, like looking out east, I had to really get some faith there. It took me a good couple of years to finally say, all right, I'm going to jump back in, because it was painful. I mean, not only did I lose that, but during that whole period of time, I went from millionaire to upside down millionaire. Like I went over $1 million in debt. I actually lost my own home in foreclosure in 2009. You know, I had to move out to a rental and everything else. And so I was really burned. I had an emotional scarring from that. And it did take me till another 5+ years before I said, okay, I think I'm ready to do this again. let's tiptoe back in. And then as I got it back into it, I thought, oh, this is actually not that bad. You know, I just had a really bad experience because I was being greedy. I wasn't following good rules. I was just trying to make a buck. And that's not the way you should be investing. I believe that the best thing I learned is that boring is sexy. The more boring the investment is, the sexier it is. Because, you know, if you're like all the people out there right now, like speculating and just going and all this FOMO, this fear of missing out going on, which I know I just got an offer accepted on my own house, you know, and just dealing with that kind of crap. Like buyers and sellers are stupid right now. Like agents are even being dumb right now. Like everybody's treating each other like crap, you know, in this current market. And you got to really try to keep a level head when that's happening. Because if you don't, you're going to get caught up in those emotions and you're going to make bad decisions, just like I did pre-recession last time.
And part of that was, of course, market conditions that none of us saw coming because we didn't understand tranches and we didn't know what was happening in the mortgage securities end of the business. But to look back at your own scenario in 2009, I know that foreclosure is a really emotional process, probably more so than a financial process. So what advice would you give to any viewers or listeners who have been through that themselves, and maybe they've been renting for the last several years as they've been recovering their credit and recovering their state of mind so that they can move forward and get back into property ownership? What tips would you give from your personal experience? Because like I said, that's not just the emotion of it is so personal and vulnerable. And of course, our society looks down on somebody that gets foreclosed on, even though all the factors can pile up and there's blame that can be tossed in a million directions. But you did that singularly impactful thing of moving forward from it. So I'd love to hear your advice on that.
Yeah, I would say this is that if you're going to try to have the faith to go back in, one, don't discredit real estate investing. Like, especially if you're an agent, right? You should be real estate investing, you know, but don't discredit it because it really is still, I think, the most amazing asset. I mean, other than your own business, I think it's one of the best asset classes you can be in. I mean, where else, especially with doing long-term rentals, where else can you make cash flow, right? The net cash flow that can be better returning than even the stock market by itself, not including the tax benefits, not including the possible appreciation, which you don't even have to bank on. I love it that my renters pay down my mortgage for me. I mean, there's extra equity being built, whether it appreciates or not. Like when you look at those total returns, there's nothing that can really compete with it other than maybe your own business where you put your time and energy into it. And so you got to have faith to go back in. I would say get somebody to help walk along with you. Like don't do it alone. You know, have somebody to be willing to say, hey, let's overcome this together. Like that's what I wish I had earlier on. Because maybe I would have got back in sooner than I did. I took a long time warming up to it. But again, everybody has their own time, but don't think that just because you had this bad emotional experience, like just like I did, don't think that that means it's always bad. Like it just means that, you know, either, like you said, one, there's market conditions you didn't expect, like very few did. And then two, just, you know, you might've made a bad decision. You know, what have we learned from it that we can be stronger and better for it?
Absolutely. So long story short, suck it up and move on because things happen. So Chris, if somebody wants to reach out to you and find out more about what you're doing in the investing space, be coached or mentored by you, what's the best way for them to find you?
Yeah, two places. Well, one, you can actually follow my own podcast, The Chris Miles Money Show. And that's a tough one to remember. It took days and days of market, you know, research to figure out that name. But The Chris Miles Money Show is a great podcast I've got there. I got like over 500 episodes there. Or you can go to my website, moneyripples.com. That's not nipples. I had somebody on Entrepreneur Magazine say moneynipples.com. It's not that. It's Money Ripples with an R.
Come on, Entrepreneur Magazine. Come on, man. Oh,
I know. That was so embarrassing. It was live too. I was like, what? Come on, guys. So yes, moneyripples.com.
And never fear, friends. I know y'all don't write anything down. You've already forgotten Chris's name, but it's okay because all of his links and information are in the show notes for this episode. So navigate your way over there. Click to follow, subscribe, and go get some more information and advice so that you can move forward from wherever you are in your space as well. Chris, thank you for coming on the show and for sharing with us a couple of insights to help make other people stronger.
Thank you so much, Lee. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, if you want to appear in another episode yourself, you know where to find me on social media. But in the meantime, subscribe for more great content. Give us 5 stars and we'll see you on the other side.
As always, I'm so super thrilled that you joined in for more crazy shit. And if you're a realtor, investor, inspector, lender, or just a regular human being who happens to have an unbelievable story that you need tell the world about, or frankly, you just need to one up the story you just heard, then make sure to DM me on Instagram at Lee Thomas Brown, or tweet me at Lee Brown, or frankly, any social network where you hang out. I'm there. And if you have some fun, then you totally want to subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes.